So just before we took a break for a second, we were talking about how you have felt that the analytical community was always vibrant and always strong, that
yes.
you've never had a problem placing your students.
Yeah.
And I asked you if you had gone to things like PitCon or some national meetings, and you
right.
said yes.
Yes.
And I was just wondering when you started going to some of those meetings.
Oh, right away. I went to Electrochemical Society meetings while I was still a graduate student, and I started going to PitCon right away as a new faculty member. Back to your previous question, though, had I noticed anything else? I did notice that L.B. Rogers left MIT, and J.J. Lingang wasn't replaced at Harvard. So there were some signs that, at least in the Ivy League area, that analytical was suffering some problems. And I was aware that it wasn't just Princeton. It did include some of the other, but certainly not Midwest.
I remember when I was an undergraduate chemistry student, someone came through to give a lecture about the importance of analytical chemistry. I mean, they were giving a chemistry seminar as well, but as part of it, they were talking about the importance of analytical chemistry, but that they saw the future of analytical chemistry not as its own division, that they saw it as something that would be important enough to defy its own division in a way and just be split amongst all the other traditional divisions of chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
But that he foresaw the future of chemistry departments not having analytical divisions. And for some reason, hearing him talk about that has really stuck with me
mm-hmm.
all these years later, because I just haven't seen that come to fruition either when I was in graduate school or in talking with
yeah.
chemists now over the years. Both those who are analytical chemists and those who are not. And I don't know, I have no way of knowing if it was just that's what he thought the future was, or if it was based on some feeling that he had from his fellow chemists that, you know, analytical is really important.
Yeah.
Everyone needs to understand it and to know how to use
yeah.
it, and it just doesn't necessarily work as its own division. And I don't necessarily have a question in that
right.
story I'm telling you, but it...
Well, let me make two, hopefully, fairly quick comments about that. One is that analytical chemistry alone now, among the four or five divisions of chemistry, as we put them together, is the only one that has not developed a science.
Mm.
And that could very well be the basis of this person's comment. Analytical chemistry is taught as a compilation of techniques. And from the point of view of the person that you just mentioned, anybody can learn a technique. I feel as though teaching just techniques is really unfortunate waste of time, and that the most important thing that I could impart to my students, graduate or undergraduate, is to give them a sense of how I think. What are the problems that attract me? What's the bag of solutions that I have to bring to those, apply to those problems? And what is the thought process that goes on in reaching some solutions? I think that that's different for analytical chemists than it is for inorganic chemists, than it is for organic chemists, or even for physical chemists. Probably closest to physical, but it's different. It is different. And the fact that we haven't formulated that, nobody has really, but particularly analytical hasn't, is part of what I think is its problem. I tried to pull that together in an undergraduate text that I wrote, but it wasn't adopted, so couldn't go up against the mainstream. but my thoughts about what analytical chemistry is and how you come to an analytical solution, I wanted to be able to teach somebody that if one day they ran across an enzyme that was exquisitely specific for a particular substrate, that they would know how to make an analytical method out of that enzyme or that substrate. And you see, people don't think that. They don't think of that. They think about, well, it's, is it chromatography or is it, is it mass spectrometry? But I was trying to broaden it out. Analytical chemistry is a very interesting, it's a very...
Hi.
Oh, okay.
I just want to say hi. So you found...
Yes.
All right. Would you like some more water?
Oh, I'm okay. I'm fine, thank you.
All right.
And you were just finishing up saying about how you wanted to teach analytical chemistry as kind of a problem solving and thinking mentality as opposed to just kind of picking a
right
mass spec or chromatography technique type of.
People think of measurements as measurements, but the thing that's unique about analytical chemistry is that the thing you're measuring is mixed up with everything else. So it's not just a matter of putting a ruler on it or measuring its mass. You have to do something to it that will, you have to learn what are its distinguishing characteristics, the thing that you're trying to analyze. You have to discover its distinguishing characteristics, and then you have to devise a means to get those to respond while everything else stays quiet, right? Now, that's a real challenge, and that is really the fundamental part of what analytical chemists do, but it just hasn't been worked out in a rigorous way. Inorganic was suffering the same problems as analytical was in the 50s and 60s, because it was a series of recipes for making inorganic compounds. But then along came the fundamental part of inorganic chemistry, when it sort of met with physical chemistry and figured out bond angles and so on, and how many complexes would fit around a nickel ion and so on, and that changed it. That put them on the map, and analytical chemistry has never done that.
Why do you think that the Midwestern universities perhaps would be more interested in analytical chemistry than some of the Ivies? Do you think perhaps it has anything to do with the application, that they were more interested in some of the applications that could come from analytical chemistry?
I think they're not as prestige oriented.
Okay.
And so they're not so worried about hiring people exclusively who have a chance to get into the National Academy or win a Nobel Prize. And so, and I think they know which side the bread is buttered on. They can be afford to be practical. This is what students want. This is what our local industry needs. Why don't we just supply it and not worry about whether it's dragging us down or not.
Now, while you were at Princeton, I noticed you were also doing some consulting work. And
yeah, I did.
Mm-hmm. So can you talk about how, you know, those opportunities came about?
I was just invited. In each case, there wasn't a lot of that.
Well, it's okay.
Oh,
it was on the table.
It's your break. Okay.
And what kind of work were you doing? I know one was Standard Oil, and the other was American Cyanamid.
Standard Oil was interesting. Not American Cyanamid, yeah. American Cyanamid, they would just put me in a room, and people would come in every hour or every 45 minutes, you know, and present me with a problem I'd never seen before and ask me if I had any ideas, you know. And,
That sounds
so
exhausting.
It was exhausting. It was interesting. It was challenging. they had just developed an LCD. This was long, long, long ago, and they wanted to patent every possible application of it, so could I think of any ways that people could use an LCD? And I said, this is so stupid. The only thing I could think of is, well, it might be handy to, if you had a telephone, that could reveal the number of the person that was calling you. That was the only thing I could come up with. Imagine all the ways we use LCDs these days, but that was... Standard Oil was more interesting. I was in their electrochemical group, so we would talk about electrochemistry and electrochemical measurements and problems and things like that. An interesting thing came up there. There was a fellow who just... There was a form of carbon that was... I'm trying to remember the name of it now, but it's very porous. I think that's what we call it, porous carbon. And so it had huge surface area for the amount of carbon that was involved and the weight. And he was measuring the double layer capacitance of this, and it was huge, absolutely enormous. And so suddenly he realized he could have a big capacitor in a very small space. And this was a way to store energy. It was a way to make a new electrical device, and this was going to be big. And I thought this was absolutely stupendous. For 25 years, it went nowhere. And now we have these supercapacitors. Finally, we have circuits for which 1 volt is a lot of voltage. We have circuits that can operate on these very low voltages that these capacitors can sustain, and we need this kind of thing, and they're called supercapacitors. But for years and years and years, it never happened.
Can you talk a little bit about the transition from Princeton to Michigan State?
Yeah. Moving back to the Midwest was getting back into my comfort zone. That's for sure. And Michigan State was a wonderful environment at the time. It was a department that had just gotten grants to centers of excellence, they were called. And what the government was trying to do was to break up this pattern where only a few schools on the two coasts got all of the research money that was coming out. And so they were trying to create these centers of excellence around. And I came into Michigan State on the Centers of Excellence program that they had there. They were expanding the department. The department was working together. I worked with physical chemists to create new courses and new curricula. It was just the whole, it was a whole new life. It really felt wonderful. I remember driving home from work one day after I'd been there a few weeks and I was whistling. And I realized that this was it. This was where I needed to be.
Were you able to start teaching the instrumentation course right away?
Yes.
Is that something you were able
Yes, right. They wanted that right away, and so, so yes, definitely. And I was still an electrochemist at that time.
Yes.
but that changed shortly. Not completely. I still consider myself an electrochemist to a considerable extent, but I had an exceptionally good graduate student. In fact, he moved with me from Princeton to Michigan State, which I thought was really tremendous. Pete Daum. His name is D-A-U-M.
I'm sorry, could you spell that again?
D-A-U-M. Peter Daum. A very, very, very bright fellow. And time for him to graduate, there weren't any departments hiring electrochemists. Electroanalytical had filled up, everybody had one. And I felt, I can't do this. I can't take in graduate students that deserve really good jobs when I know there aren't really good jobs for them. And so I started to switch. And about that time, digital equipment had come out with a PDP-8 computer, lab computer, and I managed to get a hold of one of those, and I started transitioning into automated instrumentation in general, including optical and electrochemical, and then eventually mass spectrometry.
Where did that student end up?
I think I'd rather not say it for fear of hurting somebody's feelings at this point, but he has now got a high management position at Brookhaven.
Oh.
So he's done very well.
Yeah.
But that was a definite trend you saw, where there was just the demand wasn't going to be there.
But the school that you know, the best academic job that we could find at the time did not provide him with the research support that he deserved. So,
Was it difficult to start to make the transition into kind of automated instrumentation, or was that a logical next step based on some of the instrumentation work you were already doing?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it required me to learn new things, but at the same time, I was attracted definitely into it, and I saw some opportunities to do things novel from the instrumentation standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I wasn't going to do anything novel in optics or spectroscopy at that point, but I might be able to do some things that were interesting for example, in emission spectroscopy. You know, about emission spectroscopy, there's huge empty spaces,
mm-hmm.
right? And if you want to collect data, if you're scanning, if you want to collect data and you want to get each of these lines that you've got, you want with precision, you've got to stay there to get enough counts to get a good precision. Well, that means you have to be scanning slowly through that space. And at the time, that meant you're also scanning slowly through all the empty space as well. So we devised a computer-operated arrangement where we look and see, was this an empty space or not? You can tell that soon enough. And if it was, then we move on to the next one. Is this an empty space or not? And then if we start to get counts, well, you stay there until you've got enough counts to meet the precision you need to move on. So it improved the efficiency of collecting emission spectra. And this is, so it wasn't doing anything with the optics, with the spectroscopy, but we improved the rate of data collection by a couple orders of magnitude. So,
so in order to do that kind of work, are you kind of writing computer code, or are you modifying an instrument in some way? How?
Yes. So we had to work out a means to, first of all, to interface the spectrometer
mm-hmm.
with the computer, not just for the collection of data, but for the control of the instrument.
Okay.
And so that was the part that excited me.
Mm-hmm.
Was now we could. And now the instrument control is not just by knobs and the delay time of the operator, but it's going to be done by data interpretation and the software.
What was that transition like for your students, you know, as you're moving to a different area? You know, were there students
yeah.
who were kind of in that overlap period?
Oh, yeah, there were. And I don't know. It seemed to me it sort of enlivened things. It broadened things out. And the computer part, I think, was exciting. Everybody wanted to do that. So we were computerizing electrochemical experiments as well.
And this transition started to take place shortly after you got to Michigan State.
Yeah.
Because if
that's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I got to Michigan State in 66, and this started to happen in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s. It was very shortly after I got there, right.
How did the teaching go when you got to Michigan State? Were you still as excited about teaching as you had been previously, or was the...
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. The students were different. The classes seemed to me more vibrant. There were more people in my office hours, so all that changed a little bit over time. And the transition here was also very interesting in terms of the students and the nature of the student-teacher interaction. But it was really fun, and it was pretty open department. People were looking for new ideas, and we devised a whole new curriculum that integrated analytical and physical chemistry. So we were able to teach the equilibrium with a PChem perspective, which you really should have. In a way, the analytical curriculum is still upside down. You teach these instrumental techniques to the seniors, and you could do that to freshmen just as well, almost. And we teach the analytical chemistry, which is really largely equilibrium studies and so on, before people have even learned about the Biot-Hückel equation. So it really isn't too sensible, but we haven't changed the chemistry curriculum for over 50 years.
Right.
And it isn't just the whether you have an analytical division or not, or whether the analytical division is going to be absorbed or not. The problem that, in my opinion, the biggest problem that chemistry has to survive as a discipline, as its discipline right now, has been the divisions, the fact that there were any, and the fact they got so totally compartmentalized.
Right.
Chemistry is hurting, seriously hurting as a field right now, academically. There are departments in England that have dropped it.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, not departments, universities.
Universities, yeah.
Yeah, they can get along without it perfectly well.
Wow. I hadn't realized that.
And physics is taking over. You can get courses in medicinal physics, and we're just going to get bridged. Think about it. Physics got new, got cryophysics, nuclear physics, cosmology, and so on. They're still in the physics department, right?
Right.
Where's medicinal chemistry? Where's material science? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Where's mineral science, mineral chemistry, and so on? They're not in the chemistry departments.
Right.
Why? Because they didn't fit any of the divisions.
Hmm.
And so they wouldn't hire, because they had to hire true blue organic, true blue physical, true blue analytical. And they gave away all the boundaries, all the areas where the excitement is happening.
So all that kind of like interdisciplinary, you know, wiggle room kind of work is being done elsewhere.
Yes. Yeah. Don't you think?
That sounds so sad.
It is, but we've done it to ourselves.
Yeah.
We have done it to ourselves by being so internally competitive.
Right. And so rigid.
Exactly.
So rigid in the divisional, the division requirements and... Interesting.
Yeah. It's starting to loosen up a little bit, but I think it's a little bit too late. But if you asked, can people in chemistry, they're accepting biology now and biological chemistry, But if you ask people if they'd like to bring in the Department of Medicinal Chemistry or invite the geological chemist over or whatever, it's not interested, pretty much, anywhere. Yeah, well, anyway, that's my little soapbox moment. Sorry.
That's okay. It's okay. If you can't stand on a soapbox during your oral history, when can you?
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, I think I don't have any more questions for today. I think tomorrow we can really get into kind of the transition into mass spec.
Yeah.
So unless there's anything else that you want to add for today, I think we're all set for the until tomorrow.
Can't think of anything.
Okay. Well, if you do, we can certainly make sure we discuss it tomorrow.
Okay.
And then...
What are the kinds of things? What do you want? What have you got left on your list to do?
Well, we certainly want to talk more, since we haven't talked at all about mass spec, we certainly want to talk about mass spec, both about the transition to how you got there, and about some of the kind of big accomplishments in your career in mass spec. When we talked with Mike Grayson before we came out here, and he wanted to hear a lot about the triple quadruple, of course, but he also suggested that we should be talking quite a bit about the distance of flight mass spectrometry.
Okay.
But of course, if there's anything that, you know, we kind of miss along the way, I know that there was a good period of time where you were working on electrospray ionization.
Right.
You know, certainly anything about that we can talk about as well. And of course, we want to ask some kind of... We've talked about some big picture things already today, mm-hmm. but I think we want to talk a little bit more about some big picture things tomorrow as well. Perhaps about this new interest in history and philosophy of science, and about... Well, I'm going to get the title of your paper wrong if I don't look at it. And it's somewhere... in a folder. The paper you wrote about reuniting natural philosophy and scientific research.
Oh, right. My first sort of beginnings into feeling like we should know more about what we're doing.
Yeah, well, it's something that we're very interested in at CHF. So we're hoping to talk a little bit more about that tomorrow.
Yeah, right. I think it was Feynman that said that scientists have about as much use for scientific philosophy as birds have for ornithology. And then somebody said that they thought if birds really could understand ornithology, they might get quite a bit out of it. But this is I've really been... I'm struck by this. we don't really even have good nomenclature for the philosophical terms that we use, and I think we and science journalists are very, very confused about what it is we know for sure and mm-hmm. what it is we don't. And what's the difference between fact and what are facts, you know? what do we know for sure? And then when you try to defend something that in fact everybody knows is going to change in 10 years as fact, you run into some credibility problems.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you phrase it that way. I conducted an oral history with someone who does aerosol mass spec in relation to emissions and air pollution recently, and we were talking about kind of public understanding of science and public understanding of climate change. And he said that one of the things he's most frustrated with is people will have discussions about science and about climate change, and they'll use the word belief. I don't believe that to be true, or I don't believe in those facts or in that result. And he said it doesn't matter if you believe it, whether that be a fact or just the results of a study.
Yes.
That is the results. That is, those were the conclusions that we came to. Mm-hmm. And it's not for you to believe in. It's for you to try and understand. It was more the word that he took issue with, as a, I think, in response to kind of a belief to him was something perhaps that didn't need, perhaps like coming from a religious point of view, where you can just believe in something. You don't necessarily need a scientific experiment to prove it to you. But it's interesting. It just made me think of it when you were saying that.
But he's exactly right. But the point is, even that we don't distinguish between the experimental results and observations, which are in fact factual. They are real, and the interpretation we make of them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the interpretation may change. We're learning that. I mean, what are people supposed to believe? We're now finding that the oceans are absorbing more CO2 than we thought they were going to. The ocean temperature change may not be exactly what it's predicted to be. But at the same time, the Arctic ice is sure as hell melting.
Mm-hmm.
And so, how do you hold these uncertainties or these things that we're going to learn more and better and revise and adjust and so on? And how do you hold those things up against somebody else to say, well, my theory is, this is what I believe. You know, I think everybody made it up. I think, you know, it's all just a scam to get us to use more solar power or something. I don't know. You know, but whatever the people's arguments are, as long as you're just pitting one person's interpretation against another person's interpretation, then everybody gets to play the game. And everybody can believe what they want to. But so if we don't separate, if we don't have a way to distinguish between the empirical knowledge that we have from the interpretation that we make of that empirical knowledge, and if we don't have a way to show how the empirical knowledge and the explanations work together to reinforce each other to create new science, if we don't understand that, then we're always going to be open to questions of credibility. People know theories change. They expect them to change. We expect them to change. We do experiments to change them, to test them. Right? So then how do you believe a theory? Is it appropriate to believe a theory?
Right.
Okay. But it is certainly appropriate to have confidence in experimental results that support and resupport and resupport over and over again something that's going on. And if you put it that way, it's different. But we're not putting it that way. We're having an argument over theory. Belief systems.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we get down to, do you believe in science or do you not believe in science? Well, no, I don't believe in science, but I go to my doctor and I listen to the weather report.
Yeah, there's a definite language issue.
Really serious.
Well, I think after discussing the problems with chemistry departments and the pitfalls of the way we discuss science, I think it's time to call it a day.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, good. Other things.